Hey, everybody. I have been really waiting for this day. Oh, boy, have I got an interesting guest on. You are tuned into Beyond the Matrix, the radio program that asks you to think outside the box of convention. And, boy, am I going to test you today. Ah, you know, I do love, love, love the fact that disclosure is just so imminent we can taste it. And I'm very focused on this, as you know, being a channel for sixth-dimensional beings, as I am. And a devotee of all things outside that box of repressed belief systems. So I am here to blow your mind, and that's what we're going to do today. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you all to all my friends. You know who you are. I'm glad you're tuned in and ready to hear a fascinating hour live with my very special guest. His name is Dr. Andrew Bajago. I'm going to call him Andrew so that there's no formality in the interview. Hi, Andrew. How are you?
Good morning, Patricia. Actually, let me clarify. I'm a juris doctor in our legal system, but I'm not a PhD or an MD, so I don't know if in the States I would be considered a doctor.
Okay, well, we'll just get rid of the whole doctor thing and go with Andrew.
Okay.
Okay. Before we get in, I didn't really prime the audience for what we're going to be talking about, although there is plenty of information out on the site. But we are going to be talking about just about, who knows, we're going to be talking about your discoveries of life on Mars, your teleportation into the future. Poof! This is really just great stuff. So before we get into what we're going to be talking about, please tell us a little bit about Andrew Bajago. Who is the man?
Well, I'm a lawyer here in private practice in Washington State, have been for 12 years. I grew up in New Jersey and in Southern California, spent junior high school and college at UCLA in Los Angeles, and then relocated up here to the Pacific Northwest when I attended Northwestern School of Law, Lewis and Clark College, then did a year studying environmental law at Cambridge. Currently, I'm focusing on a truth campaign really in two areas as sort of major disclosure efforts within the disclosure movement. The first is to bring public attention to the fact that NASA's images from Mars show that Mars is an inhabited planet. And that is fraught with implications and complications that we're going to have to address as a planetary civilization. It represents a major issue in the environmental movement because we're going to have to craft an international treaty to protect the indigenous ecology and civilization of Mars, basically from us. The other major
I always tell people a lot of people talk about getting humankind off the planet and starting to migrate out into space, and it's like, yeah, we've done our best to destroy the ecosystems of this planet. Let's go destroy another one.
Exactly.
I am fascinated about all of the discoveries you've made, but what's most exciting is how you got to those, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But before we get to that, I would just like to tell everyone that I am going to be taking call-ins tonight because I know people have questions for Andrew. So before we get really into this conversation, so I don't have to interrupt him, here are the numbers. And we'll be taking call-ins about 20 minutes before the end of the hour. So jot them down. This is a toll-free number. Ah, just one now. For U.S. or for Canada, the number is toll-free, 888-815-9756. Let me give it to you again, 888-815-9756. Please hold off on your calls for a little while. Let's give us a half an hour, and then we'll open up the lines. Okay, I would like to tell you, Andrew, that how I found you is that I was doing my research and I saw the picture of the blue female being on the rocks in Mars and on Mars. And I would also like to tell you that in my books 10 years ago, I declared without a question that there is life on Mars and on the moon. So anything to do with Mars, Richard Hoagland, I've been following. But you're new in my scope of attention, so I'd like to get to that place right away of, my God, talk to us about that picture that you have presented to the world, that blue lady you call her, don't you?
Right. Yeah, I was gonna though complete my thought and say the other major part of my disclosure campaign is to reveal the fact that the U.S. government is in possession of a teleportation technology that it developed in the late 60s that it's already used to get personnel to Mars. I just wanted to complete that thought. But
great. I was going to ask you about that after, you know, going back to how you actually got this incredible information.
Right. Well, as a matter of natural history, the data that I've derived that I'm using as evidence in this case aren't any of the subjective claims that I have to make about the fact that we've actually been placing personnel on Mars via teleportation, because I think that claim is going to be exceedingly difficult to prove. So I've adopted basically a more cautious strategy, and that is regarding the fact that Mars is inhabited, and that is to take NASA's own photographs and show what's in them. And so I've been publishing a series of papers at my website, my Mars website, which is projectmars.net. And so let me explain how I made the initial discoveries back in early 2008.
Please.
I took a photograph, which is really the most important, probably the most singularly significant photograph that has ever been taken by human beings from Earth, and that is NASA photograph PIA-10214, which the Mars Anomaly Research Community is calling 10214. That was taken in November of 2007, beamed back to Earth in January of 2008. It's a westward view of the West Valley of the Columbia Basin in the Gusev Crater of Mars that the rover Spirit took in late 2007. And we were able to begin analyzing it in 2008, and we found essentially that there's evidence of humanoid beings in that photograph. In fact, here we are, soon it'll be January of 2010, 2 years after that photograph has been available, and there has not been a presidential announcement in this country of the fact that the American Space Agency, and indeed an American lawyer, namely myself, working essentially not in concert but ultimately toward the same cause, have shown humanity something that we've never seen before, which is a humanoid being, actually a number of humanoid beings, living in their natural state of existence on Mars. So essentially, it's no longer a speculative question of whether Mars is inhabited or not. What has to occur is our civilization has to adjust to the evidence that is now available to us, which is in that photograph.
Well, yes, but of course, we are going to hear plenty of skeptics say that you think that it looks like humanoid figures, but they're shadows, they're illusions, just like we got with the Cydonia landscape back in the Hoagland days.
Well, in fact, just taking the issue of carved faces and heads and so forth, that is such a distinctively Martian art form that just on Tsiolkovsky Ridge, which is a landmass of about, NASA says it's about 100 feet wide, in photograph 10214, I've isolated 13 boulders that have been carved into faces. So we're really in a new era here in which the data is verifying the basic premises that researchers like Richard Hoagland and Mike Barra, Carl Munk, of course, did the study of the D&M pyramid complex near the face on Mars at Cydonia and found a similar allocation of forms at the Giza Plateau in Egypt, at Avebury in England, and indeed in the Washington, D.C. site plan. So essentially the supposition that's been advanced by this first important generation of Mars researchers, I believe, has now been verified in my own work. I don't think it's any longer a question of whether the face on Mars at Cydonia is artificial or not. Of course, Dr. Tom Van Flanderen found that the chances that it's artificial are 1,000 billion billion to one, which is like saying there's one grain of sand on every beach in the world that would suggest that it's just an accident. But in fact,
yeah.
Martians are terraformers of their own planet, and I found extensive evidence of carved sculptures. Essentially, they have a penchant for taking a boulder and carving it into a head or a face. And that's what I believe we see at Cydonia, although in a very massive form. I found similar forms as well from the satellite image that the European Space Agency has taken of the Rule Vallis, which is an ancient river channel on Mars, that also show extremely huge carved faces and profiles and heads of both human beings and animals.
How exciting is this? And are these images available on your website?
Yes, I have a section there at projectmars.net entitled the Annals of Mars, MARS, namely the annals of our organization, the Mars Anomaly Research Society. And I've been writing about Mars now for over a year and showing what I think is clear, cogent, and convincing evidence that Mars not only is a location where there is evidence of ancient life, but indeed of current life, of modern life.
Well, this is, you see, this is the really interesting aspect, because I'm following it, of course, in great detail, although I only came across you recently. But we had the famous fossilized Martian rock that Clinton tried to disclose as containing possible fossilized remains of past civilization. I had to laugh at that. But anyway, at least he was trying. And that disappeared. And now, just weeks ago, NASA has quietly announced that they do indeed believe that these are fossils. So there's no question that we are slowly being prepared for disclosure. And I'm just so excited. And for you, especially how you get to this information, which, of course, we're going to be talking about, it is such an exciting thing to be, for all of us who are working to disclose this information, to be a part of it and to be seeing, after so many years of our lives trying to get the word out to people, to be seeing it unfolding before our eyes.
Yeah, that you're speaking of the announcement by NASA in 1996 that they had found a fossilized bacteria from Mars, or virus, some kind of...
Yeah, well, they found the rock. They found this in the rock, and then Clinton and the president, or the head of NASA, came out and made a statement that there was possibility, and Clinton talked about it too, but then it disappeared.
Well, but I'm fairly certain that that was a disinformation ploy. The actual announcement of the bacterium or the tiny ancient life form in fossilized form on that rock, because indeed our aerospace community has been in liaison with the human civilization on Mars from no later than 1970, because that was the year that my late father and I, who was an aerospace engineer in that community, met three Martians as they were leaving the Curtis Wright Aeronautical Facility in Woodridge, New Jersey, to return to Mars.
Okay,
so
hold on. This is going to be a little bit... This is like casually mentioning. Let's get to a presentation of how what you're talking about for people that are at least maybe just coming into conversation, or who are not in awareness of teleportation and time travel. And let's talk about what happened to you as a child with your father and your experience with time travel.
Well, yeah, as I was saying, the second major component of my truth campaign is simply to alert the American people and the people of the world that the U.S. defense community achieved operational teleportation, that is, physical teleportation, through vortal tunnels that are opened up in the time-space community with a technology that was found in the papers of Nikola Tesla at the time of his death in 1943, and that the Defense Department was working with for years before they then accidentally discovered that that particular set of drawings was of a teleportation device. And so I was brought into the defense project as a child experimentee and trainee in 1967-68, when I first teleported to Santa Fe, New Mexico, from the Curtis Wright Aeronautical Facility in Woodridge, New Jersey. And so we can date the emergence of teleportation in the U.S. defense technical community to that time frame, the 1967-68 time frame.
Are you telling us that you consciously, as a young boy, let's see, how old would you have been?
I was six in 1967-68. I was born.
Okay, so as a six-year-old, you were conscious that you were being teleported into another time frame?
Well, I was as conscious as that I had shown up in my first grade class. Yeah, I went up with my dad to Curtis Wright, and there in Building 68 was a device that was essentially consisted of two parenthesis-shaped objects on the floor of the room that were propagating a kind of a shimmering energy field. And my dad explained that he was going to hold my hand, and we're going to jump through that energy field and find ourselves in a sort of a tunnel. And then we would pop into view on a hillside, he said, somewhere else in the country. In fact, it was the state capitol complex in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
that is outrageous.
I fell from Woodridge, New Jersey. And we then took a car and met with Dr. Agnew when he was the director of the weapons division at the Los Alamos Labs. That's another reason why I'm waging this truth campaign, is because the true story of the emergence of time travel in the United States is that as a result of Nikola Tesla's papers being seized by the War Department during World War II, time travel has always essentially been sequestered in the Defense Department as a result of being weaponized, as a result of Tesla's papers being made secret and released only to the Los Alamos physics community that initially was gathering there to build the atomic bomb, but that since then has evolved into a multi-trillion dollar enterprise where all manner of technologies are under development at the Los Alamos National Labs, at Sandia National Labs, and so forth. So I first had the opportunity to physically teleport to across country to New Mexico. My dad was presenting a prospectus during that meeting to Dr. Agnew to involve civilians in the teleportation project. And when Dr. Agnew asked my father, well, how was your trip? I guess he might have been assuming we had flown there from the East Coast. My dad said, oh, it was fine and fast. And then Dr. Agnew looked up at his desk and said, oh, did you take the teleport? And my father
really?
Said,
really?
Yeah, and then he looked over at me and said, so did my young son, Andy. And then Dr. Agnew looked over at me and said, how old? And my dad and I said, six, you know, that I was a six-year-old. So we can date the time frame from that part of the discussion. And then my father asked, have you tried it yet, namely the teleporter? And Dr. Agnew again looked up from his desk as he was reading the prospectus and said, no, but I want to, from which I think we can infer that operational teleportation was a newly emerging technology at that point.
Right. But how does it feel to be, well, at the moment, the only person I've ever heard of who has recall of having this experience?
Well, you know, I've decided to just go forward and tell the truth. I mean, I know I'm engendering substantial amounts of disbelief and criticism, but
and what about danger?
I was advised by the Bush White House in 2003 to essentially stop researching, writing about, or talking about my experiences in Project Pegasus. So they said, the representative of the White House said, we can't guarantee your survival, which may have either been a veiled threat or simply an advisement that I was discussing and researching something and beginning to write about something very
It doesn't sound that veiled to me, Andy.
No, I think it was a threat, and so I basically informed them that I would cease and desist, but then carried out my investigation secretly. So at this point, I've got basically I have a comprehensive account, an insider's account of the emergence of time-space exploration on the part of the U.S. government from the perspective of not just an insider, but an insider who was a child during the time that the project emerged.
Ask you something. Do you have a recall of the actual process of what it was like to go through this time travel process? Was it like blinking in and blinking out? How did it feel? What did you experience?
Oh, no, you remain fully conscious. It's a little bit overwhelming, particularly for a child, and that's one of the things they were testing. They were testing our cognitive and physiological responses to the experience of teleporting. Essentially, you leap through sort of a shimmering curtain of light, a field of energy that's being propagated between the two armatures of the device. And you immediately find yourself in an illuminated tunnel that is not unlike the near-death experience descriptions that we have of a tunnel of light. But the tunnel is far more turbulent than that. The tunnel is racing past you in bands of transparent light, so that if you look to the left or right at the tunnel, you see a series of images from interstitial dimensions that you're moving through as you move from one point to another in the same dimension in our time-space reference. Okay, so you sort of see a cavalcade of rapidly moving images that are holographically fixed in the walls of the tunnel. So you have these bands of light that make up the tunnel. You can then see something in the distance, initially a small pinprick of light, and then it emerges very quickly, and the tunnel simply stops, and you find yourself completing your footfall in another location. So essentially what the device does, it moves the universe past you. And so the laws of relativity are in place. You sort of feel like you're leaping somewhere, but you also sort of feel like you've just leapt up into the air and not gone anywhere while the tunnel was brought past you. So it was very much more like the description of teleportation in the television show Sliders than the opposite form of teleportation, which was illustrated on Star Trek. We
this must have been, I'm sorry to be facetious, but I think a little humor helps bring this information across. And it must have been a heck of a thing to bring back to school in show and tell time.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, when it was first shown to us, the first question from one of the other children in the program was, is this going to be like on Star Trek? We're going to stand on this platform and be turned into 1,000 bees of light. You know, so
wow.
We were kids. We were small school kids, and we asked, is it going to be like being shot out of a cannon in the circus? And if it is, will there be a net? it was scary, but it was certainly at least an e-ticket ride by amusement park standards. You know, it was scary.
Talk about starting off life with a bang. I am just amazed by this story.
And then you get there.
I have to tell you that there aren't a lot of things that completely blow my mind, but this is one of them. I'm just fascinated.
Well, I have all the information from the program there. You know, Patricia, I've spent 10 years going back and researching what happened to me. I have 225 passages that I'm going to craft into my book. And some
when is this book out?
I hope to have it sort of wordsmithed into proper form in 2010. So I'm using the technique that Voltaire used. You know, when he went on a diet, he used to go around saying, Voltaire is on a diet. So he would stay on a diet. And that's what I'm doing with my book writing regimen. I'm saying Andy is completing his book in 2010. So I will complete it by then.
Oh, Andrew, that is just outrageous. All right, so after that first experience when you were six, you proceeded to continually go through this teleportation tube?
Well, that was a sort of a one-off experience with my father. I think that his motive was to bring his youngest son to show Dr. Agnew that if the technology was safe enough for his six-year-old, it was safe enough for anybody's six-year-old. Because my father was certainly a supporter of the notion, you know, and adherent to the notion that the teleportation technology should be perfected, made safe, and used as at least a prevalent form of civilian transport, for example, between major transportation hubs, replacing, you know, long-distance commercial aircraft to get people between major cities in the world. So I'm fairly certain that he brought me along to show Dr. Agnew that it was safe enough for children, and that by the time he drove me up to Dr. Agnew's office at the Los Alamos National Labs, but, you know, I was fine, and I had adjusted to the fact that I got to Santa Fe in a very time-urgent way, so to speak.
What a privilege. It's for normal people who are having, just being introduced to these concepts, it is, I'm sure you get ridicule and resistance, but for people that are listening to this program, I'm sure that there is just awe and excitement hearing from your mouth, that personal experience of time travel. All right, so after the childhood experience, you later on in your life became involved with Project Pegasus. What is this Project Pegasus?
Well, Project Pegasus was essentially the U.S. time-space program at the time of its emergence. And so while I had this teleportation experience in 67, 68 as a six-year-old, it wasn't until the fall of 69 when I was seven going on age eight. This was right after the lunar landing, when they created a structured program to actually train us for the different forms of quantum access that were then under development. They had seven different technologies to either send people to a past or future location, there were several that achieved that in different ways, or simply to allow them to derive information, to derive intelligence from the past and future, from non-local events. The thrust of Project Pegasus, which was under DARPA, and which was furnishing intelligence to the Central Intelligence Agency, was the programmatic purpose was remote sensing in time. It was an intelligence gathering program. And so they were working with both adults and children to essentially derive intelligence from everything from conventional remote viewing, which is what, psychic time travel, all the way to the utilization of stargates to visit the future physically and retrieve information and bring it back. So I think the significance of my account is it establishes that when this kind of research was emerging in the early 70s, it didn't just involve remote viewing. That, in a sense, is what I call the high-psi cover-up, the emphasis on the parapsychology research of that era. That was only a small component of the project. they had different devices and methodologies for either sending somebody to a past or future event, either physically or virtually, or to enhance their psychic performance so that they were able to recover reliable intelligence from non-local locations in the time-space continuum. So that research was far more extensive than it's been previously revealed, and that's what my book will articulate, the different methodologies that were operational by 1970 that allow the Defense Department to essentially perform quantum access. So I kind of avoid the term time travel because it encompasses other methodologies that don't involve necessarily traveling anywhere.
Except such as remote viewing.
Yes. For example, remote viewing, psycho-spiritual time travel involving the Montauk chair, which is the focus of the Project Montauk account that Nichols and Moon provide in their books. The Montauk chair essentially prompts the consciousness of the person sitting in the chair to an event in their own subjective experience in the future. It allows them to pre-experience some of their life experience and then report back what was going on. There was also a form of virtual time travel that was permitted by these hologram-generating devices called chronovisors that two Vatican priests, Ernetti and Gemelli, developed in the 1940s and working with Enrico Fermi, perfected by the early 1950s, that recovers moving images of past and future events that can then either be viewed externally or experienced when one stands in the hologram that this particular device generates. And that wasn't time travel in the sense that we weren't going to those past and future locations. We were experiencing them in a laboratory as a result of being on the stage when the hologram was propagated. But then I must add that because we had achieved teleportation, and we had by 1967-68, and by fall of 1970, I can verify the fact that they were able to adjust the teleporter for time. We were moving people back and forth between non-local locations in the time-space continuum by fall of 1970. For example, when we were teleporting back to Curtis Wright throughout the summer and fall of 1970, which was after a year that we had spent in this specialized learning environment that they placed us in, we began to notice that they were placing us back earlier in the day. I mean, we would spend the whole day in New Mexico, and then we would find, upon returning to New Jersey, it was let's say 11 o'clock in the afternoon, and the sun was still near the mid-heaven. So we asked them, you know, are you setting us back in time? And they said yes. And we asked them, how far back in time can you send us? And they said, right now, 12 hours. But
wow.
Certainly by the time that I was marshaled out of the program in the summer of 1972, we were sending people to the far future and having them teleport back. In the case of the kind of localized time travel that was going on, one of the limitations of teleportation is because you're physically sending somebody somewhere, you have to have a teleport on that end to send them back. So the actual physical time travel was constrained within the technical limits of having to have a teleporter on both ends of the
sure.
Period.
Something like the Stargates that we were shown on TV.
Yeah, but there was no limit to the holograms that they could generate to access any past or future time, because that was a way of virtually accessing the past or future. And we were essentially experiencing a virtual reality created by isolating a signal of a past or future event and then amplifying it in the laboratory. So that the reach of that form of travel was unlimited. There was no need for a device on the other end to send us home by.
I see. Let me ask you a question. DARPANET, you mentioned DARPANET. What is DARPANET interested in?
Well, DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. They pioneered the Internet with DARPANET, so that's how they're sort of publicly positioned as the Defense Research Organization that brought us the Internet. When I was initially attached to Project Pegasus as a small child, they were still ARPA. And over the years, they've alternatively been DARPA or ARPA, either the Advanced Research Projects Agency or the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Okay. So should I be flattered that they come and investigate my site?
yes. They do far more than glue cameras on the backs of bees. They achieved time travel 40 years ago, so I think you should be very, very flattered.
So something on my site interests them.
Presumably, yes. I get a lot of hits from DARPA, too, and it always gives me some sense of nostalgia.
Okay, I'll think of it as a nostalgic thing for me. Wowee. All right, so you are implying that, well, no, you're not. You're stating that people are able to, they have been projected into the distant future, you said.
Well, we were able to be teleported to the distant future because the distant future contained, in fact, the project hub, it was in a building in the year 2045. We were able to jump from 1972 to 2045 physically via teleportation because there was a teleporter there that we were then jumping through to get back to, actually it was a location in southwest Colorado. We were jumping through a stargate in Sirius, New Mexico in summer of 72 and arriving in a plaza, sort of like in an R&D park with this beautiful green building. It was a beautiful emerald glass building. It was about three stories high. And we would walk in and be given microfilm canisters, that is to say microfilm in these small canisters, that we were then taking back to our time. And we would jump through a teleport there that was actually recessed into the wall of the conference room. So teleportation is operational as a very dominant form of civilian transport by 2045 because it was literally recessed into the wall. So we were jumping at the wall, and then we were, again, going through a vortal tunnel in time-space to the ground surrounding the microwave tower at the Lobo Overlook site in north of Pagosa Springs, due west of the Continental Divide site. In southwest Colorado. We were able to do that because they had set up basically teleports on both sides of that system or that network. So we were jumping back in time because there was a teleport there. We certainly couldn't have, I mean, we could have teleported as many years into the past physically, but the problem was we would have been stranded there unless the project brought a teleport there and assembled it for us to get home with. Because the teleportation does not require a device on the receiving end to arrive there, but it would certainly require a device to get home.
Sure, sure, I understand.
So the probes into the modern and very distant past that we were taking, Project Pegasus, were the result of being immersed in the holograms that the chronovisors were generating. Because in that case, we were literally inside a hologram of the past. We weren't in the literal past. We were in a version of it that was being propagated in the hologram.
Gotcha. Now, wouldn't you agree that we're in a hologram now, or what we call the present?
In fact, we are. In fact, Project Pegasus not only proved the existence of the multiverse, because every time they sent the same child or another child to the same so-called past event, it was always changing a little bit. But when they were physically spinning us to go out of body, which was one of the seven modalities of quantum access that they were experimenting with, we would go out of body and continue on an astral projection until we reached a kind of a physical limit to this non-physical realm that we were spiritually accessing. Again, very much like the near-death experience. And I would find myself moving forward rather than up from my body after a certain period of time. And I was sort of soaring along towards an event horizon where I could see all this information moving below me, towards me, and everything above me was moving in front of me, away from me. And I realized I had reached a sort of a physical limit to the hologram that we find ourselves in. So when I was brought back, when my astral projection was prompted by being spun like this, when I went back into body and I was questioned by one of the psychologists from DARPA, you know, one of the team leaders from the program, I described how I sensed, this had happened several times actually when I was out of body, that I had reached sort of a physical limit to the fourth dimensional reality that we inhabit. Because we were in that. We were literally out of body when we were having these astral projections. And, she said, yes, many people are reporting that. We think it's the infrastructure that's propagating the hologram that we find ourselves in. We're calling it the Matrix. And that's a direct quote. Okay. And that would have been 1969-70 when I was a third grader. So the U.S. Defense Department was already calling the device that's propagating the reality that we find ourselves in the Matrix in 1970. And I don't know when the feature film came out, but it was, what, 20, 25 years later?
Probably.
So I don't know if it was borrowed from the project, but that indeed is what she told me. And that also confirmed a claim that was made to me by Dr. Eldon Bird, that the U.S. Navy had concluded that essentially the reality we find ourselves in is an illusion. It's a simulation made out of light that is actually being propagated by a machine. So when you go out and look at the night sky,
boy. It is a great illusion, but yeah, I think we are really waking up to understanding that it is an illusion, and what a time for human beings, for all life on this planet, as all of this starts to unfold, when people like you can come out and say what you're saying and not be put away.
Correct.
People like us, I should say, because I've got my own weird explanations for what's going on as well.
So reality is far more like the Truman Show. Or the Matrix, and I'm showing sort of this theme of the, of God's handiwork. I'm showing some of the mechanisms behind the illusion. But I'm not really an adherent to the notion that idea needs to be sort of widely disseminated. I don't know how important it is, because we're still living in a reality that we have to cope with, and that has certain laws and conditions that are in place and so forth. But that was, in fact, what Project Pegasus concluded.
Well, what's important about it, if you don't mind my interrupting you, is that we are able to, like my show says, think outside the box of convention and start to contemplate. I mean, what throughout existence, man contemplates his role in the universe, but never like now are we, well, at least never like now as in time as we, as recent time and humanity as we know it, as civilization as we know it, have we had so much incredible information at our disposal. Now, here's a question for you. How many other boys, children, as you talked about, are also, let's say, could also talk about this procedure? Are you a loner out here, or are there others like you, and are you in contact with them?
Well, I am now, but I have interviewed some of the other child participants. And by the way, they were equally balanced between boys and girls, because they were
testing. That's why I find it myself.
Yeah, I think one of their goals was also to test the teleportation on children, so that when the president and other executive branch officials teleport with their family, they would know it would be safe for the sons and daughters, of our leadership community. But I did search out. Well, there were 140 children involved. That was both. We were informed of that when we were being educated on the project, and that was also confirmed for me by Courtney Hunt, who was a CIA officer. That began briefing me about different things in the early 1980s, and in fact, essentially trained me for my two quick jumps up to Mars. And he was informed there were 130.
Okay, hold that thought for a minute, because I am going to open this up for calls. Let's see, I've got to pull back up the number to call. It's 888-815-9756, and if I don't hear you right away when you've gotten through our switchboards, just let me get to the end of a sentence, and we'll bring in your question. We've got to talk about. Well, let me reintroduce you for people that have just tuned in. I'm talking to the remarkable Andrew Bajago. We're talking about way out stuff, which is what we do best, and we're talking to a true expert, talking about time, space, technology, and all kinds of great things. All right, you said you took two leaps up to Mars. That's got my attention.
Right, presumably because I'd been one of the children who had teleported 10 years previously in Project Pegasus and was essentially familiar with the sensations and the perceptions that you experience when you're teleporting. Courtney Hunt asked me throughout the early weeks of the summer of 1981 whether I wanted to go to Mars. And I initially told him, well, no, not really. But then he insisted that I had to do so. I really couldn't opt out. And so he took me to a building in El Segundo, California that was a CIA facility. I made a recent trip to Los Angeles, and I think I've tentatively identified the building, but that's going to require more research to verify the building and where it was, where the landscape around it was in 1981, almost 30 years ago. But essentially, we went up an elevator up to a fifth floor of the building, and there was a counter that we walked out of the elevator, and he checked in and gave my name and then asked me to step into the what he called the jump room. I said, well, what do you mean, the jump room? Well, the jump room was the elevator. So I walked back into the elevator. It went up maybe three more flights, and Courtney was talking to me through the intercom and said, "Are you ready?" And he kept on belaboring the experience of going up to Mars. And I finally became exasperated. I was eager to go, you know, to begin the experience. And I said, "Light this candle," which was a line from the Mercury program. I forget. I think it was Alan Shepard or somebody that said that when he was at the capsule. And Courtney laughed ruefully, only in the way that career CIA can, or pirates, right? He laughed very, very cynically, with a cigarette painted voice. And the experience began. I didn't have a sense of motion, but about 10 minutes later, the elevator began to morph into more of a cylindrical shape, and I had to sort of lean against the wall because the box-like jump room of the elevator was becoming more like a cylinder. And there was a great sensation of pressure, sort of like when you're scuba diving. So let's say beyond 40 feet or so, you start to get that pressure in your ears and your head and just your whole body. And then after several more minutes, the elevator began to resume its natural shape, and it opened up, and, you know, the morphing stopped, and it opened up in this underground base on Mars. And as Courtney had informed me, when the elevator door opened, I would see that I was in sort of this concrete bunker. And over on the right was a cement stairway up to an area behind a skull on the surface of Mars. The Martian underground is identified on the surface of Mars by different sculptures of heads and faces and so forth, and skulls of animals and humans, because the humanoid civilization on Mars built those to identify to themselves where they could get access to their underground civilization. And that may very well be what the face on Mars is. It's just one of these large terraform structures on the surface that indicates that there's an access point there to the Martian underground. And I walked up, and I walked through the eye sockets of the skull on the surface and stepped out, and immediately this young human walked up and greeted me. He sort of walked from behind the skull and quickly was there. And he was laughing at me because I was yelling. I had a communication device in the helmet, but I was yelling in my helmet, "Can I take off my helmet?" And he said yes, and I took off my helmet, and I could breathe on the surface of Mars. It was fairly warm. There was a slight tinge of blue to the sky, a predominantly rust red, sort of Sedona, Arizona look to the landscape. But I went up there for about an hour or so on my first trip, and then later in the summer, in August of 81, I went up with Courtney, and we walked around for 3 or 4 hours on the surface and encountered different life forms. So I certainly had an empirical background, a personal, you know, experiential background, for being able to identify some of the life forms that we're now finding in NASA's own photographs.
That is really remarkable stuff, Andrew. So this really validates a lot of things for me as well, because my books talk about life underground in Mars, so it's nice to have that validation from your experience. And I would like to ask you also, I've got so many questions for you. Are you going to come back on for another interview real soon?
Certainly, we can make it a thing if you'd like.
Oh, we're going to have to, because I'm only getting warm here. We're getting close to the end of the hour, and the questions are just popping up in my head like crazy. Okay, here's a question for you. First of all, I mean, obviously people tell you that they think you're nuts, right?
Well, no, I'm getting, after I appeared on Coast to Coast, for example, the email that I was getting was running 19-1 positive. Now, one thing I found about the negative feedback I'm getting is it's often factually invalid. In other words, I've received very little valid criticism. Usually when somebody tries to negate what I'm saying, they get the facts of what I'm alleging incorrect, and they also engage in personal, you know, ad hominem attacks that are irrelevant.
Right.
I've received very little intelligent feedback. I almost think that when something is true, as my claims are, that there may be some sort of universal law that's in place that causes somebody trying to negate truth to simply get it wrong when they're attempting to negate what the person is saying.
I like that concept, and I think you may very well be right, because it is absolutely the hour now for this information to emerge, and we know that we've got help on so many levels and so many dimensions.
Well, it's almost like negating the cosmic truth is a form of insanity, because very little of the criticism of both my claims about the fact that Mars is inhabited and also that the U.S. government has achieved teleportation-based time travel have contained accurate information about me or what I'm saying. I'll just give you one example. When the news director for the Hubble Space Telescope, Ray Villard, criticized me, my claims that Mars is inhabited, in a 3,000-word hit piece that he published on the Discovery Channel website, of all places, he said, you know, if Bashago says there are these little leprechauns on Mars, why doesn't he show them in his papers? And that, in fact, was the thrust, has been the thrust of my papers. In my initial paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, which was published on December 12th of last year, I showed multiple images of humanoids on Mars. Now, I have to ask, was that a form of disinformation that Mr. Villard was engaged in, or is there some sort of universal law that if you try to negate a truth, the universe somehow responds to adulterate your own data? Because I'm telling you, Patricia, I would say that at least 90% of the pieces that have been published attacking me simply don't get it right, factually speaking. And I'm endeavoring, I mean, I've been sleeping maybe 4 or 5 hours a night for a year here, writing my Mars papers and trying to get it right. I've been showing the data. I've been trying to articulate what's in the photographs accurately. You know, I've informed the reader when I'm speculating. And trying to derive what we can infer from the data. But the data is there, and we have to, you know, pull our heads out of the sand and confront the fact that the planet that every 2 years comes closest to Earth is an inhabited planet, and that means, for starters, we don't want to go about the business of colonizing it, because that literally could initiate an interplanetary conflict of some kind.
Agreed. What do you think that they're doing up there with those Martian rovers?
I think they put the rovers up there to try to disinform the public and make them believe that that was the limit of their of space science's achievement of a presence on Mars.
I agree with you.
Rover program is a disinformation program.
That and the fact that people get bored anyway. I mean, you put up we've got three machines up there now, as I recall, definitely two. And nobody even really thinks about that. We get the occasional photo, and that's that. So it looks to me like we're always being tested to see how we react to what is being leaked to us, with specifically with regard to life beyond our borders.
Right. Well, the rover program is a legitimate mapping exercise, but what they're concealing is the U.S. presence on Mars. Let me just cite one photograph that's already in the public domain. I've printed a version of it in one of my papers at the Annals of Mars. And that is the photograph that the ufologist Bob Dean shared with everybody at the European Exopolitical Summit in Barcelona, Spain, this July, which shows an irrefutable image of a base on Mars. And so that's what they're not showing the public. This is a cover-up that has several levels.
Yes.
They're not showing us the satellite image that shows bases that are either U.S. bases or that are extraterrestrial or Martian bases. So I mean, we can't say that particular base is a U.S. base, although I know that there's an American presence on Mars because I interacted with American personnel on Mars. But that base essentially creates a rebuttable presumption that that's either a base from Earth, from an indigenous Martian civilization, or from an extraterrestrial presence on Mars. And certainly the U.S. government doesn't confront that data. They also don't confront the data that they're publishing that I believe accidentally found images of the indigenous Martian life forms that then were inadvertently leaked in their photographs as a result of not having enough personnel to Photoshop such data out of the images that they've been capturing on the surface of Mars.
Because do you think that they are allowing people like you, allowing us to leak this information slowly but surely, test market the public?
Well, that was certainly a leading question that we had to ask. Are they allowing a controlled release of information so individuals like myself would come along and analyze what's in their data, or were these accidental releases of information? I believe that this is data that has leaked through their system of filtering that data out, because we found extensive data, you know, extensive evidence of them manipulating the brightness and contrast of the images, the color scheme of the images, and scale. So, and we've also found evidence of photoshopped overlays concealing certain life forms. So I think the scant data that we have, that we may find in 1 out of 1,000 pictures, is simply data that has leaked through and beyond their ability to contain it and not disclose it. Because if you look at the fact that, for example, when I was publishing data showing an image of water flowing from a pipe into a catch basin, that you can see in image PIA 11049, which is a southward view from the Home Plate Plateau into the southern reaches of the West Valley of the Columbia Basin of the Gusev Crater of Mars. NASA was then announcing that it had found ice on Mars. So if it really wanted to engage in the controlled release of information like that, it would have dispensed with this practice of making announcements of de minimis discoveries on the surface of Mars that contradict the more wide-ranging announcements that independent researchers like myself are making.
The difference is that once NASA says it is so, they're responsible for it, whereas if they let it leak out to people like you, they can always say the guy's nuts and he's dangerous and still study and analyze the reaction you're getting with your information without ever taking a stand.
I'm open to that possible construction of the facts, but I don't believe they've done that because we're not convinced that they even have the personnel to properly analyze and filter the data, because we've seen that.
Well, wouldn't that be just like the government? They don't have personnel to handle the photos, but they've got a time travel device where you can pop out of reality.
Yeah, if they had enough GS-13s on the concealment effort, they would have concealed life on Mars, I believe. Because if they were truly disclosure-oriented, now that my information has been in the public realm for almost 2 years, they would have addressed it and confirmed that it shows, that it proves that Mars is inhabited. And since they're remaining silent, I can't believe that they would have just used me and others to discover what they had previously found. I don't believe they have the personnel that is actually evaluating the data sufficiently to either announce what is in it or to conceal what is in it.
Well, my point is that they're not ready they may not be ready, or they may not have been ready to come boldly out and talk about what they have, because we're really seeing this leak almost daily now, little dribbles of information, the little bomb on the moon to see if they had, if we had water on the moon. And I mean, there's no question about it that we're being programmed to get ready for disclosure. I think you'll agree with that. But I don't see happening yet.
I'm a little bit more critical of their motive than that. I believe that they're trying to serve two masters simultaneously. I believe that they're trying to adhere to the decree that was established by the Robertson Panel in 1953, the Robertson Panel report, the Durant report of the Robertson Panel, and essentially debunk all evidence of extraterrestrial life. I think they're doing so in a way that seems to involve also adhering to their legislative mandate established by 1958. Which was to essentially foster the expansion of human knowledge of space. So I think by making these de minimis announcements, when Andy shows that Mars is inhabited, they announce that there's methane on Mars. And when Andy shows water falling from a pipe into a catch basin on Mars, around which you can see humanoids standing, they're announcing, let's say, that there's ice on Mars. If they were just engaged in grooming the public, preparing the public for a major announcement that Mars is an inhabited planet, I don't see why they wouldn't embrace my data. Instead, they seem to be publicly releasing contrary information to sort of contain the issue, to engage in a public, to use a phrase from Watergate, now that we have Marsgate, to basically engage in a public limited hangout of more de minimis discoveries, simply conceal the fact that they already know that Mars is inhabited. I mean, they must have access to my data. If I find DARPA and NASA and other U.S. science agencies visiting my website, they have access to my data. And they have more sophisticated means than I do of analyzing what's in the images.
Well, we're going to have to leave that question hanging in the ears of who has been privileged to listen to you tonight, today on my show, because we're out of time. So I'll leave you with that question. Audience, fellow star people, and Andrew has agreed to come back on, which is exciting. So before I go to sleep today, I will try to get a new date to have him come back, and we'll just take it from here, because we're just scratching the surface of his knowledge and the surface of Mars. And before I go, Andrew, can you give us your site again so people can go out there and check out what you're doing?
Certainly. I'm putting my Mars findings at www.projectmars.net, and that has a companion Facebook group site, which is called The Discovery of Life on Mars. And then my Pegasus Revelations, where I've launched Project Pegasus to call for disclosure of the U.S. government's teleportation capability so that we can use it to achieve planetary sustainability. That information is in process. I'm beginning to develop my other website, which is www.projectpegasus.net, and the companion Facebook group for that site is called simply Project Pegasus. And on that site, I'm going to be publishing more data and actually roll out my disclosure of information about what DARPA achieved in time-space exploration 40 years ago that I was directly
involved. All right, well, you have a new groupie. I will be following everything you do. And I thank you for an hour of just total revelation. You will come back soon, promise.
Certainly, I will. Thank you for having me on, Patricia. It was really fun.
Thank you, Andrew. All right, everybody. I hate to say goodbye to Andrew. It's really hard with all of my mind just going crazy here with things I want to talk to him about. But we will have him back next week, Saturday. We've got Linda Moulton Howe talking about cattle mutilations and the whole mystery behind that phenomenon. So don't forget to tune in. Please spread the word. We really want to get more people listening to these true devotees of bringing truth out to us. Help me reach more people to hear truth, or at least truth as I understand it. Goodbye from beyond the matrix. I'll be with you next week. Please be with me. This is Patricia Corey going, no, no, no. Goodbye for now.